Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and at Bloomberg.com. Let's turn our attention now to the world of international trade with Robert Lawrence. He is professor of international trade and investment at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He's also a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He's also a former economic advisor to President Bill Clinton, joining us from Boston, home to Bloomberg 1200. Robert Lawrence, how are you, sir?
I'm very good, thank you.
All right. So what, you know, if you were going to be a trade advisor to foreign governments, particularly China right now, what would you be telling them about the direction of U.S. trade policy?
Well, I tell them that they have to take President Trump very seriously, because although you need the Congress to approve trade agreements unilaterally on his own, the president has the executive power to withdraw from trade agreements that the United States has signed. So I do think they have to take his threat seriously, although it's still, there's still a huge amount of uncertainty as to exactly what he intends to do.
Professor Lawrence, there's a lot of discussion about TPP and NAFTA. When we talk about TPP, which provisions are sort of most important to highlight to understand what the substance of this would mean and kind of how this would affect specific trade relationships with specific countries?
Well, TPP is now basically dead because the U.S. is not going to participate in it. And there's not going to be no vote in this Congress. But the basic idea of TPP was to have very deep connections and to facilitate international trade among 12 countries. The most important for us would have been Japan. The provisions eventually would have implemented free trade in goods and in many services, and also facilitated investment by firms, by U.S. firms abroad and foreign firms in the United States.
Professor Lawrence, I just want to keep focused for a second on China for just a moment here, because, you know, China is attending, obviously, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit that's taking place in Lima, Peru. Is there a chance that China will become the most obvious and dominant economic power when it comes to global trade? Because they've also moved to do international transactions in yuan, in renminbi, and we've got a counterweight to the World Bank and perhaps even in the International Monetary Fund.
Yes. Yeah, so in addition to all those other institutions which China has founded and is now taking a leadership role, what the failure of passing TPP will mean is basically that the Asian economies will be increasingly relying on China for leadership in the trading system. There's a lot of disenchantment with globalization in Europe, and we've seen Brexit, and now we see it in the United States. But that's not true of the Asians. And many of those countries in TPP showed a willingness to open their economies to each other. And they will continue, I believe, to pursue free trade agreements. But now these are going to be under the aegis of China, who was originally excluded from our TPP. But they've already launched massive negotiations called RCEP, where India, China, and other Asian economies are going to liberalize their trade and investment.
Does that mean that they're going to charge tariffs on goods coming from the U.S.?
Precisely. American goods, they'll lower their tariffs against their own goods, on their own goods, and so, but American goods are going to face higher tariffs. So when we try to sell in Japan, for instance, it's likely we'll have to, our goods will have high tariffs on them, whereas other Asian products won't have to pay the tariffs.
So there's some news that just came in this morning that Senate Democrats elected New York Senator Chuck Schumer to be minority leader. I believe that he has been pro these trade agreements. Is there any chance that some of the aspects of the now dead TPP could be salvaged?
Well, I doubt it because it is it's a very extensive package. And lots of parts depended on other parts. In other words, some countries made concessions in some areas, but they were looking for concessions reciprocally. And I think a lot of them were motivated by improved entry into the U.S. marketplace. And so we drove that negotiation. It's going to be very difficult, I think, just to take to pick and choose certain parts of the agreement.
Robert Lawrence, would you say that there's going to be a trade war between the United States and other countries?
Well, I think before we get to the war, what we're going to have is a huge amount of uncertainty. You know, we have our economy, say, and the Mexican economy are intertwined. Products, final products are made up of components from both sides of the border. And if you're a firm on either side of the border, you have a great deal of uncertainty as to what are the rules of the game going to be. And the result is we're going to see a depression in investments on both sides of the border. So I think it's so that's the first phase is going to be a huge amount of uncertainty. If we do enter into negotiations, it's possible that we could withdraw from NAFTA. We would raise tariffs on Mexican products. They would raise tariffs on our products. Now, ironically, the peso has weakened considerably. So actually, the greatest manipulator of exchange rates today, the process that's weakening foreign currencies and strengthening the U.S. dollar, are the prospect of a trade war.
So if China does sort of take the lead in Asia and there is more free trade in that region, how big of a hit could the U.S. economy take as a result?
Well, I think it could be very damaging. There are estimates. You know, the trade war requires a lot of imagination. What measures do we take? What measures do they take? I think there's just a fundamental lack of appreciation of the degree, as I said, to which we have we're part of global supply chains. 2/3 of all of our imports are not finished products. And so when we impose tariffs on those imports, we're going to hurt production in the United States. So I think there will be a hit from that in general. What people are looking at is a weakening of the U.S. economy from the trade side,
right,
with a hope that the infrastructure spending and the tax cuts will offset them.
Robert Lawrence, thank you so much for being with us. Robert Lawrence, Professor of International Trade and Investment at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. This is Bloomberg.
All right, let's turn our attention now to the oil industry. NYMEX crude is up about 0.5% right now. Taking a look at oil, we've got Javier Blas. He is the chief energy correspondent for Bloomberg, and he joins us from London. Javier, thank you very much for being with us. Tell us a little bit about the context of oil trading right now. Is everyone waiting for that OPEC meeting?
Everyone is waiting for the OPEC meeting November the 30th, but also looking at the diplomatic activity that the oil group is displaying this week. We are going to have several oil ministers, including the minister from Saudi Arabia, in an event in Doha, Qatar, having informal discussions ahead of that meeting. And what we are gathering now is a big effort over the last 3 days and continuing over the next 10 days to try to reach an agreement. It really seems that OPEC is trying hard to get all the ministers talking to each other and trying to bridge the differences. But still, as we are today, there is no deal to reduce production and try to increase prices.
How has Donald Trump's election as the next U.S. president affected the dynamic here? I mean, he said some negative things about the U.S.'s agreement with Iran and possibly has raised the specter of further sanctions. I mean, does this play into the negotiations at all?
I think that it plays at least on the psychological background of the negotiations. For sure, the Iranian negotiation is going to be thinking what is going to be coming next year in terms of oil sanctions from the United States and whether their hand is weaker or stronger with Trump in the White House. I have been talking to traders. There are many different views about what this could make for the Iranians or for the Iranian negotiation position. But certainly, it looks like more oil coming from Iraq is going to be more difficult next year. But also the other big problem for OPEC is that Trump has talked about U.S. oil independence, a big support for the domestic oil industry, and that could be a source of competition for OPEC. So if you are OPEC, you can think now, do we cut production, increase prices, use as a new president who is friendlier to the domestic U.S. industry is coming? Because what you could do is basically bankroll the shale producers in the United States. So certainly it changed completely the dynamics within OPEC, both internal negotiations, the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but also the view of the group of what is happening in the United States.
Well, Javier, let's stay in the United States for just a moment and give us your thoughts on increased activity in construction of pipelines, for example, the Keystone XL pipeline.
Well, we're probably going to see the president-elect Donald Trump green line new pipelines. That could mean more Canadian crude oil coming into the market in the next few years. It could mean also that U.S. shale producers enjoy better prices because they can easily sell their crude oil without having to rely on trains and trucks to move the crude. So in general, more pipelines and a presidency of Donald Trump means higher production from Canada and higher production from the United States. But this will take time. A pipeline doesn't build overnight, and production decisions are not made overnight. So we are talking about probably 2018, the earliest, where we are going to see impact, and probably is more a question of 2019.
So we're talking about the supply side. What about the demand side? I mean, it seems like people are thinking that perhaps demand for oil will increase as there is less emphasis on environmental regulations and carbon caps.
It could be very well be the case for the United States, but also a Donald Trump presidency, particularly some of his promises on trade come through, are particularly negative for China, India, and other emerging countries. Those are the countries that they are the real engine of global oil demand. That's where drivers are buying new cars. That's where motorcycles are being added to the roads every day. So if a Trump presidency means a lower economic growth in emerging countries in general, that's very negative for oil demand. Yes, there will be a positive in the United States that probably less regulation could mean a healthier or a more stronger increase in oil demand. But certainly China and India are the big worries here.
Javier, could this also be reflected in changes to the standards for miles per gallon for U.S. automakers, if indeed they are at least repealed or held to current levels? Will that affect people's driving habits and therefore the use of gasoline?
It could be very well. And what we are seeing already is that the lowest gasoline prices in the United States in 12 years. This driving season during the summer holidays, U.S. drivers enjoy the lowest prices. We have to go back to the early 2000s to find lower prices. That is meaning that actually the drivers are buying a lot of larger cars. The share of SUVs in total sales of passenger cars have increased to about 60%. And that is contrary to what the government was predicting that it was more or less around 40%. So the decisions that the U.S. consumers are already taking are moving us into that direction of larger cars, and even the SUVs of today are a lot more efficient than they were 10 years ago. That's meaning that the MPG rate, it's flatlining and it's actually decreasing, contrary to what the Obama administration was trying to achieve.
Javier Blas, thank you so much for joining us. Javier Blas, chief energy correspondent for London, Bloomberg, coming to us from London.
All right, we want Lowell Ura to put his knowledge to work. He is the head of multi-asset solutions at BMO Global Asset Management, where he helps oversee $233 billion. BMO, you're the name, you're the word. All right, Lowell, tell us, have you told clients they should change anything in their investment allocation?
No, we haven't. In fact, we're looking at an environment that is very well set up for further upside in equities, particularly in the U.S. The one area that we've been very cautious about, and the one area that this election in the U.S. has taken folks' eyes off the ball on, is with what's going on in Europe. And so we've all been focused on the U.S. election, and what we've been ignoring, and we think are potentially bigger risks, are the elections going on in Europe, and starting with the Italian referendum in December, then moving into the first quarter, you've got the Dutch elections, the French elections, and the big election next year to watch is what goes on with Angela Merkel in Germany. And those could rewrite the playbook in Europe.
I want to get to Europe in a second, but I want to just press you a little bit on what you're talking about with stocks, particularly U.S. stocks. One of the big argument for why stocks were rallying is that bond yields were so low and benchmark rates were so low that there was no alternative. People were going into stocks for dividends and they were considering them a proxy almost for bonds, because at least you were getting more income from the dividends than you were from some benchmark bonds. That's going away as bond yields rise. Isn't that going to be a big effect?
We don't think so. If you look at just the fundamentals and the valuations, you know, you could argue that U.S. equities are a bit expensive, but history would show us that at the levels they're trading at today, historically, you still get pretty decent returns out of equities. Now, we might not be talking about the 9% returns that investors have been used to over the last 30 years, but a 5 to 6% return out of equities should be very good in the context of low bond yields still, and potentially higher bond yields moving higher.
Could you just explain, you said earlier that you think that stocks are poised for another leg up. Why is that?
Well, you've got a couple of things. You've got a environment that is going to be supportive of growth. So some of the policies that are trickling to the top that Trump is focusing on that are supportive to growth are tax policy, less regulation, and greater fiscal spending. And those are very strong supporters to potentially top-line growth, which has been missing throughout this entire recovery. So those are really good drivers of further growth.
So let's go back now to what you're talking about with Europe, because certainly within the bond world, we're hearing a lot of concern about Italy, and you're seeing yields on Italian and Portuguese bonds rise considerably just in preparation for what is to come. How will investors in the U.S. feel the effects of some of these elections if, say, the Italian voters do vote no on the referendum, or, you know, if Angela Merkel is not anymore the president or the head of Germany?
Well, you don't have to look too far back to get a sense as to how problems in Europe have manifested in U.S. equity. So go back to the summers of 2013, go back to the summers where we debated about what was going to happen with Greece. So specific to the Italian elections, you've got a situation here with a lot of the progress that's been made with fixing the Italian banks gets turned on its head, and that could put further scare into the elections, as I mentioned earlier, coming up. And you might have this situation where the euro, which many have been calling, and we might agree under this march that we're taking here from these elections, really gets called into question is the sustainability of euro, and the unwinding of that will cause chaos that will be definitely felt in the United States.
Well, Lowell, you know, I was just to take your 3 points, right? Regulation. You say, okay, a rollback of regulations. Well, if those regulations were put in place after the debacle of 2008 recession, you could argue that not having those regulations may have contributed to that debacle. Plus, you talk about tax policy. There's no real indication about where the extra revenue is going to come from in order to pay for any of this. And then you said stimulus, that kind of combines with tax policy. How are we going to afford this?
Yeah, and I think that's where I think we need to watch where the potential for threading the needle, where you can provide enough infrastructure spending without alienating the far right Tea Party folks that have been, you know, advocating for balanced budgets and unwilling.
Well, never mind. Then the bond vigilantes.
Well,
right? People in the bond market. We saw that just recently. Bond yields increasing. People don't want to hold those bonds.
Well, certain people don't want to hold the bonds. Don't forget how many investors want to hold U.S. Treasuries. So you've got foreign buyers of treasuries that look at these yields and say they're very attractive. You've got pension plans that have been waiting for years for yields to move up so they can immunize their liabilities. And so you've got a lot of buyers that will naturally come into the market as yields go higher.
Kind of, but won't that hurt stocks?
Not necessarily, because they're not rotating necessarily massively out of stocks.
Although, you know, what you were talking about in Europe, should the euro unravel, the dollar will become even more of a haven trade, right?
Perhaps. You know, I think, you know, as we've seen in this situation, the yen is becoming the safe haven trade, and potentially the Swissie becomes the safe haven trade. But
my point being that this could even support another leg up in the dollar, you know, strengthening against other comparable currencies. And couldn't that slow growth and sort of add a drag effect to U.S. stocks?
It could. But let's look back at periods where we've had a strong dollar before, where stocks have done very, very well. So if you go back to the 1990s, where the dollar had this regime change and a large move up, U.S. equities outperformed non-U.S. equities significantly. And so we don't want to get too caught into these, you know, rules of thumb where a strong dollar is all of a sudden 100% bad for stocks. If you have a strong dollar with growth and potential, a wild card of potentially productivity gains, this could be a very good environment for stocks.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what happens, right? I mean, that's the key thing. But you say right now, no change. Don't do anything drastic to your portfolio. Don't change your asset allocation.
And you're in good company. A lot of people are saying the same thing. It's hard to sort of make concrete moves based on a lot of speculation. Lowell, you're a head of multi-asset solutions at BMO Global Asset Management, which oversees $233 billion. Luckily, he is in Chicago and can avoid the gridlock that we are seeing in Midtown Manhattan around the Trump Tower. So we wish you a safe travel back to Chicago. We are starting to have a sense of what we can imagine from the Senate. Senate Republicans reelected Mitch McConnell of Kentucky on Wednesday to be a majority leader next year. Also, the Democrats selected Chuck Schumer, a New York State Democrat, to be the most powerful Democrat in the Senate. I want to bring in Mark Niket of Bloomberg Politics team here. And Mark, what do these appointments tell us about the direction? Is anything surprising, particularly with Chuck Schumer's coming in and replacing the former leadership?
No, I think this was sort of what was expected to happen. You know, certainly we thought the Republican leadership wouldn't change. And, you know, there were signs, you know, with Harry Reid leaving that Chuck Schumer was in line to become minority leader and majority leader, actually, if the Democrats had managed to take control of the Senate during the elections.
Mark, tell us a little bit about who is vying for various spots in a Trump administration.
Well, we're hearing all kinds of names being floated about, and maybe one of the most interesting ones is Ted Cruz, the Texas senator who competed hard, obviously, for the presidential nomination against Trump. And, you know, with Trump you know, calling him lying Ted constantly. And, you know, Cruz, the last day of his campaign actually was in Indiana, and I was there, and he essentially had this press conference where he, you know, claimed that he would, you know, the civilization as we know it would end if they nominated Trump, and vowed never to support him. Well, now he's being considered, we're told, for attorney general possibly, and his name has also been thrown out as a potential Supreme Court appointment. So we're seeing a lot of people sort of, you know, work their way through Trump Tower during this vetting process as they're deciding on names. And, you know, it's a little unclear at this point who's actually being seriously considered and who's just being sort of trotted out there in front of the reporters.
Mark, you know, I've read a bunch of stories about sort of the push-pull between people who are saying we're established people in Washington, D.C., and we don't want to serve in the Trump administration, and others saying we're established people in D.C., and we think it's important to serve in the Trump administration, regardless of what we think about some of what he said on the campaign trail. What do you hear from people as far as the vast majority of people who are longtime Washington operatives and whether or not they're willing to serve?
Well, there's sometimes there's just a fundamental contention between wanting to have a job and, you know, be involved in the administration and sort of the principles, you know, like you said, of maybe in the past saying you would never serve with a Trump or you can't fathom, you know, some of his policies. So I think what we're seeing going on, frankly, is, you know, some folks thinking about, well, do I want to have a seat at the table with this new administration, even if I have reservations, or are my objections to the policies or the proposals or the, you know, the presidency itself of Donald Trump just so disqualifying I can't even consider serving?
Mark, is it a foregone conclusion that Republicans will rubber stamp whatever Donald Trump wants in terms of people and policies?
Not at all. Just like we're sort of uncertain about, you know, who Donald Trump will actually end up appointing to some of these key positions. You know, it's not a foregone conclusion they'll all get a smooth sail and through confirmation in the Senate. You know, the margin is still pretty narrow. Republicans only have a 52-48 edge in control of the Senate. And, you know, assume the Democrats, you know, don't go along. We don't know exactly how they're going to play all these individual appointments. We have Republicans who have not been enamored of Trump and, you know, have outright opposed him during the primary, the nominating process, and have already been on record saying they might not support some of the names that are being floated. Rand Paul, for example, the Kentucky senator, said that if, you know, former Ambassador John Bolton or former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani get tapped as Secretary of State, you know, he can't go along with that. So the question will be, how united are both the Republicans and the Democrats on various appointments? And you know, if we see, you know, the willingness of either Democrats to break ranks or, you know, Republicans who just can't go along, we might have some nasty fights for confirmation.
So at this point, I mean, normally when a new president-elect starts preparing for his administration, are there basic sort of mundane aspects of how the government operates that he needs to get in order before he takes the oath in January?
Yes, and there's also certain sort of, you know, key, you know, almost routine procedures for the transfer of power. You know, for example, there's a non-disclosure agreement that the incoming folks and the current administration sign just so that the inner workings of government aren't exposed while information is being shared to the incoming administration and teams are being put together. Well, we're told that was not signed until last night, essentially, that, you know, we had the shakeup in the transition team for Donald Trump where Chris Christie was shown the door on Friday and Mike Pence came in. Well, apparently nobody signed this letter until yesterday with Mike Pence heading the transition. So consequently, we lost, you know, 3 or 4 days there where information was not shared from the administration side to the incoming Trump teams looking at key areas like foreign relations and, you know, even internal, you know, agency type information. So it's been, you know, probably the most charitable word to describe the transition so far has been chaotic.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at iTunes, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm out there on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm out there on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.